on the ships and seamanship of the Bronze Age in the Levant, about which he talked to us last night at the Maritime Museum. If any of you are interested in archaeology, I encourage you to become members of the Vancouver Society of the AIA, and there are forms on the table over here, and there were forms outside. It's a great pleasure now to introduce Professor Shelley Waxman, who will talk about the Sea of Galilee boat, a 2,000-year-old wonder. Shelley.
Wow. Thanks for coming out tonight. What I'm going to tell you about is from Israel, and I'm teaching in Texas now, so I'll just begin by saying shalom, y'all. I'm going to turn off the lights, but please don't go to sleep. I like to start any lecture with a map to get us on track as to what we're talking about. And can you see this? This is the Sea of Galilee in the land of Israel. This is Haifa. Can you see this? I can't. Is there another pointer here? This is usually a strong one. Okay. Okay, can you see that? Okay. This is the Sea of Galilee where the story I'm about to tell you took place. Haifa, Tel Aviv is about down here, and Jerusalem is over here. I should point out that the Sea of Galilee is not a sea. It's a freshwater inland lake. The reason it's called a sea in the Gospels is because in Hebrew there is no word for lake. It is a freshwater inland lake. I'd like to begin with three images of very famous images of gospel stories in Christian art, and I want you to look very closely at the ships depicted in these, okay? This is Rembrandt's The Amazing Draught of Fishes. Notice the boat. Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee. Okay, notice the boat. And Delacroix's Christ on the Sea of Gennesaret. Notice the boat. What is common to all three of these boats? Absolutely nothing. How did the artists know that this is what the boat of Jesus looked like? They didn't. They went down to the local pier and drew whatever was there. But we really can't blame them because there was nothing to go on beyond a couple of references in the Gospels and in the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus about boats on the lake. We didn't actually have a boat from that time from the Sea of Galilee. Now, the story begins in 1986 when I got a message in the office. At the time, I was Inspector of Underwater Antiquities, saying that two brothers on the Sea of Galilee had found a boat, possibly ancient, in the lake, and I should go out there and examine it. Well, I called up the two brothers, and I went out there, and because it was a boat, I assumed it was underwater. I brought my dive gear and wetsuit, and we drove out to the site. And I start pulling out my tank and putting the regulator on it. And I say to one of the brothers, this is one of them, Yuvi, where's the boat? And he says, you're standing on it. What had happened was the Sea of Galilee, or in Hebrew it's called the Kinneret, and I'll use that term interchangeably for Sea of Galilee here. The area in 1986 was undergoing a tremendous drought. And because the Kinneret is a freshwater lake, it's also the main reservoir of fresh water in Israel, and water was being pumped out for various agricultural and other uses. So the level of the lake was going down dramatically, and because it's a fairly shallow lake, you get these vast expanses of lake bed that became mudflats. And these two brothers, Yuval and Moshe Le'Alufan, decided at that point that they were going to go out and find an ancient boat. They had dreamed of this since childhood. They were not divers, and they thought that this is a real opportunity to go and look for ancient boats on the seabed. They started by looking at Caperna in the area of Capernaum in the northwest, but they were soon drawn to an area next to the site of Migdal. Migdal, the home of Mary Magdalena, Mary from Migdal, which is on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. You're looking south here. This is Tiberias. Migdal is right over here. And the boat is right here. Those little white spots you see are actually little puddles of water where the two brothers had moved some of the mud away to find the uppermost plank of a boat. Anything that was above the mud had disintegrated. Now, the first question when I got there was, is this an ancient boat? Could it be an ancient boat? So that was fairly easy to answer. First of all, we have to remember that we knew nothing about boats in the Sea of Galilee, but it's not, the Sea of Galilee is not that far away from the Mediterranean, and we know quite a bit, not enough, but we know quite a bit about ships in the Mediterranean from the past 40 years of nautical archaeology. And we know that most ships there were built in a way that to us seems rather strange. Today, when you build a boat, and those that were at the lecture yesterday, this is a repeat, when you build a boat today, what do? You put down a keel, a stem post, and a stern post, and then you put on the frames. And this creates a skeleton, which gives the strength of the hull and the definition of the shape of the hull. We therefore call this skeleton-first or skeleton-based construction. In antiquity, and we're talking up to, say, the 5th, 6th century AD, they did things somewhat backwards to our point of view, and that is they would lay down the keel, the stem post, the stern post, but instead of putting the frames in, they would first build up the shell of the planking, and only afterwards would they insert the frames. Often the frames were not even attached to the keel. In this sense, the shell itself gave the strength and the shape to the hull. In terms of the two different types of construction, think of a human skeleton as opposed to an insect's exoskeleton. Okay? Now, the planks were edge-joined. Their narrow edges did not overlap. They were joined edge-to-edge. And the way they did this was not with metal fasteners, but with what we call mortise and tenon joints. These are joints, if you have an expensive table or some kind of furniture, they're still used sometimes today, in which you cut slots in the upper edge of the upper, on a ship, on the uppermost plank. You then insert hardwood dowels or tenons into the mortise so that the tenon is half of its length is in the mortise. And then you do this every, say, 12, 20 centimeters along the edge of the plank. You then go back and cut opposing mortises in the next plank that is going to come down on top of that. And you close the two planks together. You then drill holes and knock pegs, usually from the inside of the hull to the outside, which then lock the mortise and tenon construction in place. And often the seams will be wide enough to see light through, which is normally not a good thing for a ship. But in this type of construction, which does not use caulking, once you put the ship or the boat in the water, it first begins to sink, and then the wood swells, forming a watertight joint. The reason I told you all that is all we had to do is look for the mortise and tenon. If there were mortise and tenon joints, we'd know immediately that this was an ancient boat. So I got down on my hands and knees, and that's 20 centimeters. And here are the mortise and tenon scars. The tenons had broken off. And here you can see the pegs. So we knew immediately that this was an ancient boat. We didn't know quite how old it was, but that it wasn't new was absolutely clear at that moment. Now, this was a blistery February day, and we, at that point, we suddenly had a huge rainstorm. All of the people there ran back to my Jeep. We got in the car, partially soaking wet. And a moment later, the rainstorm stopped, and what we had over the Sea of Galilee was a beautiful double rainbow. You could not have ordered this from Central Casting. I mean, I began to believe in synchronicity at this point. And Yuvi, one of the two brothers who's a bit of a stitch, hit me in the ribs and said, well, now we know who the boat belongs to. And I said, well, who are you referring to? And he said, well, obviously this is the longboat from Noah's Ark. We spent the next 2 days doing a probe excavation to try to better determine how well the hull was preserved and get a better handle on the date of the boat. And this is the situation. You can see that the water is starting to come back here slightly. During those 2 days, we found two pieces of pottery, the only two that we did find with the boat. One is a cooking pot, and the other is an oil lamp, both of which dated to the early Roman period, 50 BC, 50 AD. We then reburied the boat, and we found that the hull was fairly well preserved as best as we could in these tiny little trenches we excavated. We reburied the boat. We actually tried to hide it. We dug additional ditches around the place so that if anybody would look for it, they would look someplace else. And my intention was to wait until the lake waters were coming back because of the rains and do this excavation, organize it properly and do this excavation as an underwater excavation. Unfortunately, 2 days later, this got leaked to the press, and we ended on a Friday. On Sunday, there was a little notice in Haaretz, one of the Hebrew newspapers, on page 7, about this big, about an inch tall, that said a boat from the time of Jesus had been found in the Sea of Galilee. Well, the next day, on Monday, all the newspapers in Israel and some international ones already had these front page headlines with headlines about that big that you could read under a new moon saying the boat of Jesus had been discovered in the Sea of Galilee. Now, the distance from the to a has never been that far. Jesus, to the best of our knowledge, never owned a boat. There is no such thing as the boat of Jesus. But because anybody who's read the Gospels, the whole milieu of the time of his ministry, which is undoubtedly the most important aspect of the life of Jesus, takes place in and around the Sea of Galilee with the background of seafaring, fishermen, and boats. So that's where that idea came from. But the idea electrified everybody. It became a real media carnival. People now, also something else happened. Every body of water has a legend of a treasure, right? I'm sure there are some around here also. The Sea of Galilee has a story of a Turkish ship that was carrying the payload for the Turkish army in World War I, which was sunk by the British, carrying this gold payload. So now, people around the sea, around the Kinneret, began connecting. Well, we have archaeologists trying to hide a boat of Jesus, and there's a treasure. Well, there must be a gold treasure in the boat of Jesus. And people began looking for the boat, and it would not take much for a farmer to come with a tractor and shovel and just pull this boat, tear this boat apart, looking for a treasure that didn't exist. So we at the Department of Antiquities decided, even though we weren't ready to do the excavation, we're going to go out and do the best job we can with whatever we've got. It's going to be better than having the boat destroyed, because there are a lot of examples in archaeology of invaluable artifacts being destroyed because the archaeologists didn't work fast enough. So here we are on the first night of excavation. And for the first day and a half, we worked 24 hours nonstop, trying to get this done, trying to work faster than the approaching waters that were coming up against us. And here you can see the stern of the boat. The stern was facing the shore. The bow was facing the lake. And we began excavating that night. By the next morning, you can see how close the water came. We became very concerned. There had been an easterly, what is called a sharkia wind, which blows from over the Golan Heights and can really whip up the waves on the west side. It's the worst type of storm on the Sea of Galilee, and probably in the Gospels, when we read about storms, this is the type of wind that was creating them. Fortunately, just as the waters were approaching the boat, we had help in the form of the Kinneret Authority, which is the governmental body in Israel in charge of controlling the Sea of Galilee. And they came with their people and sandbags and heavy moving equipment and built a dike around the boat, which basically, by the end of the excavation, we had water on three sides. The water kept on going up, but after that point, we did not have any more problems with it. And in the end, as I'll show you, this was actually providential. At that point, the weather turned very warm. This was February. We were all working in T-shirts. And the problem here was that the wood was waterlogged, which means it looked brand new. But you could take it in your hand and literally go like this, and it would come out, it would mush like wet floral foam. What had happened was the organic structure of the wood, much of the organic structure of the wood had been leached out by the water and replaced by water. As long as it had been contained in the mud, in the sediment, it had been preserved. By excavating the hull, we were now exposing it to air, and that water inside that was holding up each cell of wood was evaporating, and then what happens is the cells collapse and the wood starts to bend and crack, and eventually you have the whole thing falls apart. So our first job was to keep this wet and keep it cool and not in the sunshine. As we excavated, we began finding the hull itself, and it was beautifully preserved. What you're seeing here, these white lines are actually plastic string that we pinned to the hull to show the seams of the planking, which was very difficult to see, and even when looking at it, and in a photograph, this would just look like one piece of wood. And this gives you a better idea of the types of timbers that were used for the hull. Now look at how narrow some of these are. Very strange construction here, and we'll talk about that towards the end of the lecture. The boat, because the timbers were waterlogged, the timber was so soft that it could not support its own weight. It didn't have the structural strength to hold up its own weight. So as we excavated a pit around the boat, we left the boat sitting on a podium of mud to support it. As we excavated inside the hull, we came across the problem of the proverbial man sitting on a tree branch and sawing it off of the trunk, because we could not stand on the wood. You put your foot on this wood, it would go right through it. So we had to come up with a way that we could excavate inside the boat without actually touching it. And what we did was raise two bridges over the boat, and we used this to cover the entire area with a tarpaulin to prevent the sun from striking it directly. And then on that, from those two bridges, we lowered the hanging platforms of Kinneret, on which the volunteers could lie for hours on their stomachs as they excavated by hand the mud inside the boat. And this is how we continued. As this was going on, we were enlarging the pit around the boat. You can see that there's groundwater swelling up all the time. We had pumps going 24 hours a day. And to do this, because we weren't actually in an archaeological site, I felt it legitimate to use a backhoe under strict supervision. And I was working here with a volunteer named Tzvika Malach from the modern Israeli moshav, or communal farm, of Migdal. He would get up very early in the morning, tend to his chores in his orchards, and then come and visit us and work until late hours of the night with us. And as we were excavating here, we'd have the backhoe dig up a shovel load of mud, drop it in front of us. We would look through it to see that we weren't missing anything, and we were picking up small, in this corner, the northeast corner of the excavation, we were picking up small pieces of dislocated ancient wood with mortise and tenon joints in it. We'd take these, put them in one of these boxes, and then the same shovel load, once we were satisfied that we'd found everything we could find, was lifted out of the pit, and someone else would go over it with a metal detector looking for metal artifacts. But as we're doing this, Tzvika puts his hand in the water and he says, "Shelley, I think there's some wood that's connected to something here." So we stop the backhoe, pump the water out, And sure enough, Tzvika had found two parts of two additional boats. Here you can see a plank and a frame, and here's another plank. And we excavated this by hand. This is as far as we got. We didn't have enough people or resources to deal with the main boat and these pieces, so we recorded what we could. Both of these come from different boats, and they're not part of our boat, based on the construction techniques. We photographed them, recorded them, and removed them, and went back to our boat. One of the main problems, because of the waterlogged wood, was to keep the boat wet. And what these people are focusing on is nothing more than a little garden sprinkler that we had fit up there to try and keep the boat constantly wet. But this was a real fight, and it was obvious that we were losing the battle. And this is one of the reasons we were working at breakneck speeds, trying to excavate the boat so that we could get it back into water. One of the great fortunes of this excavation was that we were able to have the expert, the guy who wrote the book on ancient hull construction, Professor J. Richard Steffi, come out and visit us at the excavation to record the hull of the boat. There is a type of expert called a hull reconstructor, and there was nobody like that, including myself. I'm not an expert on ancient hulls, who could actually do that kind of recording. We were lucky to get him from Texas A&M University to come out for a week. His son was being married the next week, so we really had a tight window there in which we had to clear the mud so he could look at the wood when he arrived. Once Dick had a chance to study the hull, the next question became, what do we do with the boat? And the decision was made to move it from the excavation site to a new museum that was just being built at that time in honor of the Israeli statesman and soldier Yigal Alon in Kibbutz Ginosar. This is a kibbutz from which the two brothers who found the boat, where they lived. And the question was, should we take it apart into pieces for conservation, or should we remove it in one piece? And the answer was actually given to us, to that question, was given to us by the boat. Remember I said that the construction was mortise and tenon joints, but the frames were attached to the planking with iron nails. Because this was fresh water and the wood and the nails had been buried in an anoxic layer where there was no rust, the nails of the boat were in such good condition that when our conservator, Orna Cohen, had one sectioned in a laboratory, she found that there was less than a millimeter of rust on it. So the boat, quite literally, was hanging onto her integrity with her nails. And we could not take her apart without literally harming the boat, as opposed to ships in the Mediterranean, where because of the salt water and the chemical reaction there, usually iron nails, by the time you're excavating the boat, they're not there anymore. At most, you have a concretion or a hole where the nail had been. So how do you move a boat that's over 8 meters long, basically having the structural strength of something between wet cardboard and yellow cheese, without having the whole thing fall apart on you? Well, one of the nice things about Israel is that you can get a lot of free advice. And we took advantage of that. We went to everybody we could think of who had anything to do with moving heavy and delicate items. We went to the Army, Air Force, Navy, the airlines, the port authorities, the Ben-Gurion airport authorities. We even went to a group who's in the Army whose expertise was saving people from houses that collapsed. The basic answer we got was, this is impossible. There's nothing you can do. Build the museum around where the boat is. Well, Orna Cohen, our conservator, had come up with an idea to conserve small parts of the boat, and she suggested that this might be possible in order to package the entire boat for moving. And that was basically to build a fiberglass skeleton around the boat and then surround the whole thing with polyurethane, which is sort of like styrofoam, but you can spray it on. And we decided to go with this. It was had never been tried before. We had no idea if we would succeed at doing it. We first laid down tin foil to prevent the fiberglass from sticking to the wood. We had a team, experts from the kibbutz who knew how to handle fiberglass, started laying down these internal frames of fiberglass in between each two ancient wooden frames. Once that was completed, and this happened at night, we put plastic sheeting over the entire inside of the hull and brought in a company that sprayed polyurethane. That's what they did. And it's very unusual. This, I don't know if you can see it. This man's holding a gun that has two hoses connected to it. And the polyurethane is put on by spraying these two liquids that when they come in contact react to each other and bubble up and then solidify. And it looks almost like a living something, you know, growing. And we joked that if Hollywood ever makes a movie about this excavation, we can call it The Blob Eats the Boat of Jesus. The next day, we had the entire inside of, that night, we had finished filling the entire inside of the hull with polyurethane. We removed all the frameworks around the boat so that we had better access to it. And in order to package the rest of the boat, we then excavated a series of channels or tunnels beneath the boat perpendicular to the keel. Here you can see we're just starting on the first tunnel. As each of these tunnels were completed, we passed a fiberglass truss around the hull and connected it to the top of the boat, and then spray-filled each of the tunnels with polyurethane, and which you can glue onto the polyurethane on the top of the boat so that we had, once each of the tunnels was filled and the polyurethane solidified, we had eventually a row of external frames supporting the boat. We could then repeat the process again and, in the end, package the entire boat without moving it a millimeter, while also adding 2x4s at the bottom to give the whole thing some structural strength. Next question was, how do we move the boat? Well, there were three possibilities: by air, land, or water. By land, well, the area was very muddy. In fact, the brothers were first drawn to the site because they found coins that had been kicked up by an army jeep that had got stuck in the mud there. So you don't want to bring in an 18-wheeler. By air, the Israeli Air Force had offered one of their larger helicopters to pick it up and put it where we wanted it. Unfortunately, those large helicopters, if anybody's flown in them, have tremendous vibrations. And I was concerned that the vibrations would go down the lifting wire and the polyurethane cocoon might come out of this okay, but the boat inside would probably be matchstick. So that didn't work. Finally, one of the people from the Kinneret, while I'm sort of scratching my head there, one of the people from the Kinneret Authority comes up to me and says, polyurethane floats, the water's up, float it out. Okay. So we reversed the pumps that we had going all the time, we were very careful to dislocate the hull, so that the whole hull with its cocoon as the water filled in the pit. We then brought up a steam shovel and dug a channel through our dike to the waters of the Kinneret, which providentially had come up. And away we went. Here we got stuck on a sandbar. And for the first time in 2,000 years, more or less, the boat sailed the Sea of Galilee. The next day we brought it opposite the kibbutz, and after some head scratching, we figured out a method to build a support that we could bring the boat on land, put it in the pool that we would eventually build, and then disconnect the support so that it wouldn't bother us during the conservation process. Here's the boat is on land, and you can see this is where the pool was about to be built. We did not start work on the pool until the boat was actually on land, because to the last minute, we weren't sure that we were going to manage to successfully get the boat onto land. The pool was built in 10 days by the contractors at the kibbutz. We then put the boat in the pool, not without some adventures. The boat nearly slipped and fell. Fortunately, it didn't. And once we had the boat in the pool, we filled the pool halfway with water. I went in a wetsuit, unscrewed all the bolts. We took the support out, pumped the water out. Now we had the boat in the pool, high and dry. We now began the second excavation of the Kinneret boat. In our rush to put the polyurethane on, we really hadn't thought about how we were going to get it off. And this led to some very difficult situations in which it was much harder to excavate in the pool, because the pool was just built to the size of the boat and its packaging. And as we were taking pieces off, we had to build supports because we needed to support the boat, and we had to take all the polyurethane off. We couldn't add any water to the pool. I mean, we kept on spraying it, but we couldn't fill the pool with water until we had all the polyurethane off. Otherwise, we'd be destroying the boat because it would break into pieces. And this was a very long and arduous task. If you look at our faces here, this is when we were getting to the point of, you know, we brought it this far, but we may not make it. And look at the faces here. They really express how we were feeling at that time. To make a very long story short, we did get it into water and successfully. And here she is in the water. After that, we then had a metal structure built over the boat. I suspect that some of you might have visited the boat while she was in the stage. The boat, the pool was over here. There was a visiting area here that, as long as the boat could be seen prior to the conservation process, people came and visited. And even afterwards, when you couldn't see anything, people would come to visit and they'd be told that there was a boat down there and took it on belief. I've had a few situations when I'd be at the kibbutz and somebody would come up and say, gee, you know, it's all a great story, but there's one thing that mystifies me of this entire project. How did you get the boat through the doors? I'd like to end this adventure part of the story. This lecture is divided into two, one, an adventure part and a detective part. And I'd like to end the adventure part saying that this was a group effort. A lot of people gave of their time and expertise to do it, and I think we were all richly rewarded. You cannot buy an experience like that for love or money. And this is just some of the group. We could never get everybody at one time into a photograph. The boat, after the excavation was prepared for conservation, our conservator, Orna Cohen, decided to conserve it in a very traditional method of using polyethylene glycol, or PEG, PEG. This is a synthetic wax, incidentally donated by Dow Chemicals. We got something like 40 tons of it from them. And what the PEG does is, as you, the boat is in water, you add PEG to the pool and you heat the water. And here you can see the heating rods going down up to 60 degrees centigrade. And slowly, in a process of osmosis that took around 10 years, the PEG penetrated the actual cells of the wood, replacing the water with liquid polyurethane, with liquid PEG, I'm sorry. Once that process was completed, you then removed all the PEG and had to slowly allow the wood to dry, and then the excess PEG, the whole thing looked like it had been covered in wax, which it had to be slowly cleaned off, and we could then exhibit the boat in a controlled air environment. Now, something about the boat itself. The first question in archaeology is the dimension of time. When did this boat actually live its life? Now, in most cases, when you're dealing with a shipwreck, it's fairly easy to date a shipwreck based on the artifacts that you find inside, the pottery and the coins and whatever else it's carrying. In this case, we seem to have been dealing with a derelict. The pottery, coins really could not help. The only coin we found in the boat was a 1986 American penny, which said, "In God we trust." But I think somebody planted it there. So what I did was I went to three different methods of dating and tried to correlate them. The first thing I did was call up Dick Steffi and say, well, if this boat had been found on the Mediterranean coast, based on the type of hull construction, when would you date it to? And he said, well, I'd place it somewhere between 100 BC and AD 200. We then had a number of radiocarbon tests to date the wood, and we came up with the date of 40 BC plus minus 80, which gives us a range of from 120 BC to AD 40. We then also looked at the pottery. Apart from those two pieces I showed you, there were several other very small fragments, but diagnostic ones, and the experts who studied that were able to determine that they basically all fall within the same range from 50 BC to about the time of the Jewish war with Rome in AD 70. So when you line all of these things up, I proposed a date in the excavation report that was published in 1990 that the boat lived its life sometime between 100 BC and AD 70. Now that doesn't mean that the boat served on the lake for 170 years, but rather that it lived its life sometime within that range, and we can't be more accurate than that at this point. Now, one of the interesting things about this boat is that it's an old boat. It's not just an old boat to us, it was an old boat when it found its way into the lake where it was found. We know this because of Dick Steffi's very detailed study. Among the things he found were repairs to planking where the mortise and tenon joints had weakened, and some of these were nothing more than basically iron staples. They're about this big, that had been nailed into place in areas where the planking had weakened. We also found something that at first didn't make a lot of sense. We found places where pieces of wood had been removed in antiquity. Here's a frame station. You can see the discoloration here and the nails sticking up through the planking, but there's no frame. Somebody had removed it in antiquity. At the stern, here we have the keel coming up at the stern. There should have been a stern post here. It had, and we didn't find it, and as we dug one of the first tunnels, we found the scarf that would have attached the keel to the stern post, but somebody had removed it in antiquity. Even more curious, as we were digging another of the tunnels, we came across the, here you're inside one of the tunnels looking at the keel sticking out from underneath the hull. And here we see a row of, what are these? Mortise and tenon scars. What are they doing here? Absolutely nothing. This is a reused piece of wood. So, and now, remember that picture, that slide I showed you at the beginning with the, when I showed you the plastic string, the white plastic string, how narrow some of the planks were? What we're seeing here is a situation of real wood starvation. This boat is being made by somebody from really inferior materials. Not only that, but there are 11 different types of wood in the hull, indicating that the boat builder took anything he could get his hands on in order to build this boat. In many cases, pieces of wood that on the Mediterranean coast would have been used for tinder. Okay? Dick Steffi, the first day he arrived at the boat and took a good look at it, really got upset. He takes these things very personally, and he just said, you know, this boat builder had no idea what he was doing. Look at the planking scheme here. Just, you know, this makes no sense. He had just come from looking at another boat that had been found in Herculaneum, which had these beautiful planks that ran from stem to stern, just, you know, center of the Roman Empire, absolutely beautiful. And here he suddenly comes upon this piece of junk wood boat. And he really, that first day, he was really upset with this boat builder. He really does take it personally. The next day, he came back with this beatific smile, and he said, you know, I was absolutely wrong. This guy was a real expert. He knew exactly what he was doing, but he was dealing with inferior materials. He was making something out of nothing. And this is a remarkable example of really pulling everything together to get something usable out of materials that normally would have been tossed away. One of the most memorable moments in the excavation was the first day that Dick arrived on the scene, and I asked him to draw once he had had a chance to look at the boat, I asked him to draw a picture of what he thought the boat looked like. And he said, well, this is a later lines drawing of his, but it basically showed what he had in mind. First of all, this dotted line is the starboard side of the hull, the level of preservation. Said it probably would have had a cutwater bow because he found a tang at the bow rather than a scarf, and a recurving stern. And I asked him, well, would this have had a sail? And he said, well, I haven't found a mast step on which a mast would sit, on which, because you need something to prevent the mast from going through the hull. Later on, he found a discoloration in the center of the hull with four nail holes, which where the mast step would have been, but somebody had removed it in antiquity. And I asked him, well, how many people would have rowed a boat this size? And he said, well, there would have been four rowers probably for a boat this size, a little over, with all its pieces, it would have been around 9 meters long. And he went back to work, and about 5 minutes later, I got a visit by two Franciscan archaeologists who had been excavating actually at Migdal and came over to visit the excavation. This is something very common in Israel where all the archaeologists are visiting everybody. And while they're visiting me, not to be outdone, they said, well, you know, we have a boat also in our excavation at Migdal. And I said, oh, gee, that's interesting. I thought this was the first one. And he said, no, this is a mosaic of a boat. And I said, well, could you draw it for me? And he drew it, and I almost, you know, fell over backwards because it looked exactly like what Dick had just drawn for me. This is the Migdal mosaic. It dates to the first century AD. You can see the cutwater bow, recurving stern, the mast, the yard, and the furled sail, and some of the rigging, the rowers, but it's got three rowers. And I thought, well, I said to the gentleman, I guess your boat is bigger than ours. We figured ours would only have two to a side. It was only later when I was preparing for the excavation report, and this was before the days of PowerPoint and scanning and in Photoshop, I took this slide or one like it and put a piece of paper on my refrigerator and scanned it onto projected it onto the refrigerator and started drawing each stone. It was then that I noticed that the first two oars are single lines of tesserae, of mosaic stone. The third one widens at the bottom. Wow. That third oar is not an oar. It's a cutter. It's a quarter rudder. In other words, Dick was right, and this model, mosaic actually shows a boat just like ours. This is a boat that had four rowers and a helmsman. Okay, a crew of five. And that, suddenly, you know, in the cartoons where somebody has an idea and a little light bulb goes on, that's what happened to me at that point. Because I was trying, I had three different things. I had the mosaic, I had the boat, well, I had the boat, first of all. I had the mosaic, and I had references in the Gospels and in Flavius Josephus, two boats on the lake in the first century A.D. But I couldn't figure out, how do you figure out whether you're talking about the same type of boat in each case? Okay? And I wasn't trying to find out if this, you know, if Jesus had ever sailed on this boat or if it had been on one of the recorded boat trips. The question to me was, is this the type of boat referred to in the Gospels and in Josephus? Well, as soon as I realized this, I ran to my office and pulled out the Gospels and Josephus. And first, in Josephus, there is a story in the Jewish war in which he describes, he was the commandant of the Galilee at the beginning of the revolt. Vespasian is coming down. The city of Tiberias is trying to go over to the Jewish city of Tiberias is trying to go over to the Roman side, while his center is at Migdal. In Greek, it's called Tarichai, or a place for salting fish. He had just, at this point, a group of Roman cavalry come to Tiberias, and they decide they want to go over to the Roman side. Josephus in Migdal hears about this, but he has just sent all of his troops home for R&R for the weekend. So what he does is he realizes he has to figure out some kind of a ploy to get Tiberias back. What he does is he takes all the boats that are on the lake. He had a little fleet that had been sitting there in the harbor at Migdal, and he puts skeleton crews in each of the boats and sails them out to Tiberias in order to frighten the people of Tiberias into going back from joining the Romans. And he says that he collected 230 boats with no more than 4 sailors in each, and with his fleet made for full speed for Tiberias. Then once he gets opposite Tiberias, he cows the people of Tiberias into giving him hostages, and he sends those back to Migdal. And when he's talking about that happening, he says, as the boats were successively filled, he ordered the captains to make with all speed to Migdal. So if we turn this into an equation, we have 4 sailors, 1 helmsman captain, 5-man crew. Same type of boat that we're dealing with, and the same type as the Mosaic. Now, moving to the Gospels. We know of 2 specific boats in the Gospels. There are a lot of references to various boats, but there are 2 that are mentioned specifically regarding ownership. The first belongs to the family of Zebedee, and in Mark 1 we read, Jesus went a little farther on, he's walking down the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he saw 2 brothers, James and John, sons of Zebedee. They were in the boat getting their nets ready. As soon as Jesus saw them, he called them. They left their father in the boat with the hired men and went with Jesus. So if we turn this into an equation, we have 1 Zebedee, 1 James, 1 John, 2 or more hired men, a 5-man or more crew. We're talking about the same type of boat. Others of the disciples making a 7-man crew. Now, if you're going to go fishing, you're going to need more people than just the rowing crew. So again, we're talking about the same type of boat. Now, one of the big questions we kept being asked by people visiting us at the excavation was, how many people could get into the boat? Could Jesus and the 12 apostles have sailed in this boat? Well, the answer was we didn't know. Until we had a chance to take a look at both at the Gospels and Josephus. And after reading the Gospels for about the 15th time, I realized that nowhere in the Gospels does it say that Jesus sailed on the lake with the 12 apostles. What it says in each of the cases of these voyages is that he sailed with his disciples. And we know that he had many more disciples than he had apostles. The apostles were chosen from the disciples. So the Gospels really don't help us in regard to how many people were in the boat at any given time. However, Josephus comes to our help again, and in describing the sham fleet and taking the hostages, he talks about his own boat, the boat that he sailed over to Tiberias in, and he says, he went on board one of those boats with my friends and the 7 armed men, that was the only group that he kept that weekend, from his army, and sailed for Tiberias. And of course, the boat had a crew also. So in Josephus's boat, we have 1 Josephus, 7 armed men, 2 or more friends, 4 sailors, 1 helmsman. That's 15 men or more. Just to show that this isn't a fluke, when he takes aboard the first hostages in the boat, he says, 10 citizens, the principal men of Tiberias at once came down. These he took aboard one of the vessels and carried out to sea. Obviously, the boat had a crew. So again, we have 4 sailors, 1 helmsman, and 10 men of Tiberias give you 15 men. So the answer is, had Jesus wanted to sail with the 12 apostles in a boat like ours, yes, he could have. But how much would they have weighed? Well, I put this question to a friend of mine who's a physical anthropologist at the Department of Antiquities. Took one look at me and he says, we can't weigh people from those days. But what we can do is there are equations of height versus weight. And if you've ever done insurance, you're an insurance policy, there are all these different tables of height versus weight. And he said, give me a chance to look this up. And he came back a little while later and said, well, the average height for a Galilean male is 5'4.5", based on skeletons. Now, that would put you in the weight range of around 137 to 148 pounds, or 62 to 67 kilograms. Because they're probably eating a leaner diet than we do today, these are calculations of today's population, probably around 63 kilograms. Here I've got it in pounds, but 140 pounds by 15 men would have been a ton, and the boat could have easily carried them. While the newspapers and the media were really having a field day talking about the boat of Jesus, we at the excavation were thinking that this boat might be related to another historical event. Josephus tells us about a battle that went on between the Jews and the Romans on the Sea of Galilee at Migdal, when Titus, the son of Vespasian, took the city of Migdal by swimming his cavalry around the land walls of the city into the city and began slaughtering the Jews inside. Some of the Jews managed to get onto these boats, the same boats that Josephus had used in the sham fleet, and sailed out into the water. The next day, Vespasian came by, ordered a type of boat that Josephus calls in Greek schedia, which is usually translated as rafts, but doesn't make sense as a raft. In the excavation report, I proposed that what they actually were doing there were taking available boats and putting pairs of available boats like ours, putting fighting platforms over them and creating catamarans. Anyhow, during the excavation, because we were digging in the dark, taking out clumps of mud, we couldn't be sure that we weren't missing artifacts. So I had something done, which is kind of unusual on an excavation. I recorded all the mud as artifacts. And we loaded it up in these boxes and gave each box a number, recorded it on our daily diary, and after the excavation went back and checked all the mud. And the most interesting artifact, there were very few artifacts, but the most interesting one was an arrowhead, iron pyramidal arrowhead, exactly of a type found at a site in the Golan that was taken right after Migdal. This is a coin, one of the Judea Capta coins, that in which Titus has his foot on the prow of a boat. Now, inasmuch as there were no other naval actions during the entire Jewish war that could really be connected with a naval battle, this might be the only reference we have outside of Josephus to this battle. And this is the site of Gamla, which was taken immediately after Migdal, in which thousands of arrowheads were found in this area where the Romans broke through. And what's interesting is we have the identical type of arrowhead. So that arrowhead itself might have come from the battle. That does not mean that the boat was related to the battle. An arrow could have floated in there afterwards. In 1992, there was a terrific drought on the Sea of Galilee. The same drought had continued up until the time I decided to go there and try and do another excavation, at which time there was a huge rainfall and snowfall on the Golan in the Hermon, and by the time I got there, everything had filled in again. Going back there with a bottom-penetrating sonar, we tried to locate the site. Unfortunately, trees had grown there, so we kept on getting the bottom-penetrating sonar stuck on trees, underwater trees. But I have no doubt that there are more boats out there from the battle itself. Josephus talks about the entire shoreline being covered with broken hulls and the bodies of dead Jews. What was the boat used for? Probably the owner of this boat would have used it for anything that he could get, could make a dinar off of, or a shekel off of. But the main purpose of a boat this size on the Sea of Galilee must have been fishing, and probably fishing with a specific type of net, the seine net. This is the type of net which is cast from shore, brought out. One line is placed on shore. The net is spread out, catching a shoal of fish between shore and the net, and then the net is drawn to shore. When Jesus talks about heaven being like a net, he refers to this type of seine net. He says the fishermen bring the net to shore, and they choose the good fish and the bad fish, and they keep the good fish and throw away the bad fish. What he's actually talking about is they keep the kosher fish, which have scales, and throw away the catfish, which is the only non-kosher, therefore non-commercial fish in the lake. We know this also because boats of about the size of the canary boat still existed on the lake in the early part of the 20th century. These are arabia boats, and you can see that they have a large stern deck. They were usually from about 7 to about 9 meters in length, and the stern deck was used to put the seine net because it's a very heavy net and you can't use it from the well of the boat. This might also explain something when from the Gospels when Jesus is sleeping in the stern on the pillow. During a storm, Jesus would not have been sleeping on a deck like that, but he certainly, the quietest place in the boat would have been below the stern deck and away from the waves and from the helmsmen and other people. When I came to Texas A&M, I wanted to keep on doing research on the canary boat. One of the things I did was fund a graduate student, Bill Charlton, to spend a year and a half to build a 1 to 10 scale model of what we think a Galilean fishing boat of the first century would have looked like. This is what the model looks like. The little guy here is about 5 foot 4.5 inches in scale, and that is our best guess as to what these boats would have looked like. The model is now on exhibit next to the boat, and this is the boat today in its in a special wing of the Egaleon Museum, beautifully preserved, and I hope that you'll all get a chance to visit it and enjoy, spend some time with it. Thank you. That's the end of the lecture, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions. Yes.
What was the preferred wood for making ships in that time?
In the Mediterranean, Aleppo pine is usually the most common. Later on, they go to Cyprus. In this boat, I don't remember the whole list of woods that that was used here, but the most of the planking was made out of cedar, which suggests that it was parts of an older boat or an older construction that was reused, because I don't imagine somebody who owned this boat could afford bringing cedar down from the Lebanon, because no cedar grows in Israel. Most of the frames were made out of oak, which grows locally. Yes? Yes, we did. Did we do any radioactive dating? And the answer is yes, we did. As I showed, we had about 10 or 12 tests, which gave us a date of 40 BC plus minus 80. And because, I should mention, the evidence, as you've seen, suggests a reuse in wood, I have a feeling that that date, we have to sort of go towards the later part of it, because we're probably looking at a boat in which pieces are being reused over and over again. Pieces in this boat may have come from two earlier renditions of a boat. So I would go more towards the AD part of the date sequence here. Yes?
Roughly, how long would these boats last?
That is the question is, how long would these boats last on the lake? That's a hard question. The best I could come up with as an answer was I checked on boats on the Nile, wooden boats on the Nile, and they usually last between 10 and 20 years. And I would guess that probably 10 years of good use, somewhere between 10 or 20 years of good use. You're welcome. No, what I said was this boat is probably the timber that was used in this boat, because what we're seeing is this situation of recycling, that the timbers that are used in it probably came, a boat was built, it was then taken apart, the parts that were reusable were taken apart, but used for a second boat, then used possibly for a third boat. If you remember that slide with the planking that looked very narrow, why would you... Dick, this is one of the things that drove him nuts. Why on earth would you use such narrow planks? There were some cases where he thought in order to make a plank, a plank that could be put on the hull, the shipwright, the boatwright, actually had to put several planks together to build one plank. And that's what confused him at the beginning. I'm not saying that this boat went someplace else, but rather that the timbers in it were probably, at least some of them were probably reused from previous hulls. Did you?
I hesitate to put this question because it has nothing to do with the Sea of Galilee. However, you did mention the Eastern Mediterranean. Is there any truth in the suggestion that boats from Phoenicia went round across the Biscayan region?
The what? The question was, towards more antique times, is there any evidence for Phoenician ships getting to England? The only evidence that we have for that is from ancient Greek authors. We have nothing from the Phoenicians. As far as Phoenician material, the farthest north on the North Atlantic is in Portugal. I was there last year looking at three sites with Phoenician material at a site called Santa Olaya on the Mondego River. And beyond that, we can only conjecture. Now, the reason for going to England was presumably for tin, but if you look at a metal ores map of Iberia, you'll see that there's a lot of tin in northern Portugal and also in Galicia, the northwest corner of Spain. So whether they actually got that far, you know, until there's actually archaeological evidence, I'd be hesitant to say that. Yes?
I have an acquaintance, and he's a professor here, actually, at UBC, and they are from Cornwall, and one of their names has Baal, B-A-A-L, in their name, which was the Phoenician god.
Uh-huh. One of the sites I was working at, it was called Abul, which is not, but you really have to be careful when it comes to names. Places can be renamed, stories can be attached from, hey, I'm reading this in this historian. Let's.
The Cornwall people have dark curly hair.
I rest my case. I'm not saying that it couldn't be. I'm just saying that there is not archaeological evidence for that at this point. I think it would be wonderful if they did find it. There's no reason. I mean, I would be happy if there was evidence. There's stories of Phoenician coins being found in I think the Madeira Islands or the Canary Islands, which is really fascinating. But the coins disappeared and we don't have them. So, I mean, these are all things you can talk specifically about sites in which you have artifacts that can be identified as Phoenician. Beyond that, you're into the realm, in my view, of speculation. I'm not saying it's impossible, but we don't have the archaeological evidence to support that.
Were there forests in Israel at that
Yes.
So why could they not just go out and get some new wood?
Well, if you read the portion of Josephus dealing with the Battle of Migdal, he splices it, and in that he talks about the Valley of Gennesaret, the Valley of Ginosar, this exact area, and he says, this is the most wonderful area. It's got all sorts of trees that grow all sorts of wonderful fruits and in plants. When Vespasian comes to build his Schedia, perhaps catamarans, Josephus has a throwaway sentence there where he says the vessels were built quickly because there was no lack of technicians or carpenters and plenty of wood. So why do we have a boat that's built out of bits and pieces? Well, there's a difference between a Roman general with three legions and a poor fisherman. This guy, I mean, there are two possibilities. Either they're lacking wood, or this guy, the guy who owned this boat, was very, very poor. I tend to think, because of what I just mentioned, that he was probably very, very poor. And this gives us an entirely new picture of the economics that you read about in the Gospels and in Josephus. When they're talking poor, they're talking poor. This is the guy who owned this boat was not at the bottom of the economic food chain. He could hire men to work with him, just like Zebedee did, right? And he'd pay them in fish from the fishing expedition. Yet he's using a boat that, let me put it this way. When the storm came up and the disciples were frightened, I would have been frightened too, to be in a boat like that. Let me get somebody farther back. Yeah. Did everybody hear the question? When I was talking about mortise and tenon joints, I mentioned that normally the pegs in this case, the pegs holding the mortise tenon joints are usually hammered in from the inside of the hull to the outside. And wouldn't it make more sense to go the other way? I have an answer for that, but it's a bit technical. I believe that this form of mortise and tenon joining of the edges actually comes from an earlier tradition of sewing. Hulls can also be sewn. We talked about this yesterday. In other words, actually sewn together with ropes. And there is a tradition in the Mediterranean where once, after the holes have been laced, you bang in little pegs to hold the rope in place. And there are mortise and tenon joints that aren't pegged in this type of construction. We have examples from the 6th, 5th century B.C. down to around 400 B.C. I think what happened was, at an earlier time, and this is pre-1300 B.C., somebody made the leap and said, instead of lashing the boat or sewing the boat together and using these unpegged mortise and tenon joints, why don't we just peg the mortise and tenon joints? When you're doing that in sewing, you always nail it from the outside in, from the inside out. And I think they just continued that tradition. But that's my opinion. I might be wrong. Okay, dendrochronology is the dating of timbers by counting the wood rings and by comparing different trees of different ages and linking the rings. Could that have been useful? I would have loved to do that. And in other excavations that I've done, I've sent off wood for dendrochronology. The problem was I always got the answer back, we don't have this in our, the wood you're sending us does not fit any of the information that we have. We do not have a good record for the area of the Israeli coast. We have a good one for the area of Anatolia. Dr. Cunningholm at Cornell is working on that, but we really do not have a good series for the Israeli coast. And every time I sent him something, I got back the answer, we can't date this, we don't have it in our record. So I would hate to cut and this would require an actual piece of the boat. So I'd hate to do that until there is a big enough database to make it worthwhile. What has most interested me about the boat or in general? I think it's the moment of discovery. And that can happen. The question is, what was the most exciting thing for that ever happened to me? I have to say it's the moment of discovery. It's the moment when you suddenly think, oh my God, this is an ancient boat in the Sea of Galilee. It can also be sitting in a library and looking at some iconographic drawings of 2,500 years ago, and suddenly you make the connection, you suddenly see something that nobody else had noticed, even though it had been on a wall for all that time. I'd have to say it's that moment of discovery which is worth everything. Is that it?
I'd like to call on Professor Nancy Galini, who is the new Dean of Arts at UBC.
Well, Dr. Waxman, I am sure that everyone will agree with me that that was an absolutely splendid, magnificent talk. It was just really awe-inspiring. Now, as an economist, I have to admit that I am not well-versed in the fine points of underwater archaeology, but I can say that this talk was many leagues more interesting than most economics lectures that I've heard. I mean, you know, economics can be very fascinating, I'll have you know. But I mean, you know, let's face it, we have the first editions of Adam Smith, and that's a far cry from the boat of Jesus, right? Anyway, it was really terrific. And so on behalf of UBC, the Vancouver Institute, the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies, and everyone here, please accept my deepest gratitude for a fascinating, fascinating talk, and also for staying over a day, an extra day, so that you could share your knowledge with us. But if I can just... Oh. New dean, I would like to just point out a few things. I am most inspired. I don't get out of my office too much. I've been here now for 2 months and 9 days, and I know I'm not counting, but I don't get out of my office that much. But when I do, I am most inspired when I can participate in the intellectual activities on this campus, such as tonight. And this is the first time I've been to the Vancouver Institute. I just want to comment on what a wonderful forum this is for bringing UBC to the community and having the community come to UBC. And I'm just very impressed with the number of people who showed up tonight in this kind of dismal weather. I really want to encourage you to take advantage of all the other wonderful activities at this university. There's the Museum of Anthropology, wonderful exhibits going on, the Belkin Art Gallery. There's performances at the Freddie Wood Theater and the Chan Center, and of course the public lectures here. So please do take advantage of these great activities. It's just wonderful seeing you here. And while I'm on the topic, also as a new dean, I've been trying to find out as much as I can about the Faculty of Arts. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about something I learned as a result, again, of tonight's lecture. There is a small but powerful unit in the Faculty of Arts called the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies. And I thought when I first heard about them that it was quite a good department, but after tonight, they've gone up quite a few notches. I also did some digging in preparation for tonight about this department, and I found out that they have had a very long-standing relationship with the Archaeological Institute of America since 1918. And they boast, as you heard earlier, of James Russell, who is the only president of the AAIA who's from a non-American institution. And they also boast of Homer Thompson, whom you can read about when you go outside, who was trained at UBC. And there's also amazing archaeological research taking place in this department. Again, James Russell and Hector Williams and Tony Barrett and Lisa Cooper, who are heading excavation sites all over the world in Turkey, Syria, and so on. And so Dr. Waxman's visit tonight is really testimony of that very strong relationship the department has with the Archaeological Institute of America, and I want to encourage that relationship and hope that it strengthens all the more. So again, thank you for coming tonight. It was absolutely wonderful, and we hope you'll come back as soon as possible.
Just to remind you that next week's lecture is Mr. Daniel Snowman, a noted British broadcaster and author, who will be speaking about Hitler's emigres, the contribution of refugees from Nazi Germany and Europe to the intellectual life of Britain.